Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this series, Discussions in Depth Psychology. Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. I'm your host, Bonnie Bright, and I'm an alumna of Pacifica, and I finished my doctorate in depth psychology there and had really wonderful exposure to so many different depth psychological topics and to Jungian psychology. And so this is just my way of trying to give back a little bit to the community and to be able to contribute to conversations that I think are really important in extending depth psychology in the world. And my guest today is Tom Elsner. So welcome, Tom. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie. Pleasure.
Well, it's great to see you. I have to say, in full disclosure, you were one of my professors when I was at Pacifica several years ago. We won't say how many, but it was really a wonderful experience because the class that you were teaching was on alchemy, and that's one of the things that we're here to talk about today.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good to see you again. It's been longer than I would have thought.
Well, let me tell everybody just a little bit about Tom so that you know who he is. And by the way, Tom is conducting a 3-day workshop on alchemical active imagination, and that's March 4th through the 6th at Pacifica Graduate Institute. So you can find out more about that workshop at www.pacifica.edu and then look for the public programs there. Tom Elsner is a certified Jungian analyst, faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute, and a member of the C.G. Jung Study Center of Southern California. He trained as a lawyer and then as a Jungian analyst at the Center for Depth Psychology. In his research and training of Egyptian, Islamic, and European alchemy, he continues in the lineage of Jung and von Franz's work. The author of numerous articles, Tom has taught courses at Pacifica on alchemy for over 7 years, as well as presenting this material in England, Ireland, Switzerland, and throughout the United States. He has a private practice in Santa Barbara and is completing a book on Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, as seen from the alchemical and depth psychological perspectives. So great, Tom, there's so many things in there. I don't really quite know where to dig in, but maybe it would be best if we start talking about active imagination. And of course, it's something that is a practice quite commonly known to most people who have been exposed to Jungian or depth psychology. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the history of active imagination and how that came about and what Jung's role was in that.
Sure. And this relates to the workshop that I'm doing at Pacifica 2 in March, which is about alchemical active imagination. As far as I can tell, how active imagination started off with Jung is through his own experience. It wasn't something that he had read about, you know, or learned about academically or intellectually. It came about during the time that after he broke with Freud and he was going through a really intense personal crisis of his own. I mean, he was really in the soup. He was really in dire straits, going through a pretty severe depression, having lots of visions, deep dreams. And he began working on what's now, you know, been published recently as the Red Book. It's a 16-year-long process in which he painted and gave voice to, wrote his inner dialogues out. Basically, he found a way to turn his crisis into a work of art and a process of development and transformation through his engagement with it. So this is what he began to call active imagination, the process of making one's subjective psyche objective in terms of images, voices, experiences that he initially had within himself, and entering into a dialogue with those images and voices. The main idea is that Jung became actively engaged with emotional drives and dynamics that otherwise really would have overwhelmed him. And he discovered that a process of development opened up through that engagement. Mm. Then when he, around that time, 1916 through the early 20s, was discovering alchemy, he realized that in this text, the weird text of alchemical symbolism, which seems so nonsensical and bizarre, that the alchemists were having similar experiences to his, similar symbolic experiences. You know, so the imagery of alchemy, he saw that in his own dreams, in his own paintings, in his own fantasies, and the dreams and fantasies of his patients. So he realized that through alchemy, what was really going on there was a process akin to his own, active imagination. It's what alchemy was really about for him. Then he really caught on fire with it once he saw the relevance of alchemy.
Yeah, that, you know, it's so fascinating to sort of look at the timeline of things, because obviously, once he became what we know now to be a psychologist and was really one of the huge pioneers in the field of depth psychology per se, I think that not everybody really realizes that he had so much influence from many other kinds of fields. He was really trying to make psychology an interdisciplinary field, and he really, I think, greatly wanted to be the scientist at the beginning of his life, at least, and perhaps gave that up a bit as he went along. But this sort of discovery of active imagination or the development of the process, I don't know if he considered it scientific, but it certainly must have kind of thrown a wrench into the process of what it was that he was trying to do.
So that's a great, really great question. There's so much in what you said. I agree with you absolutely about the interdisciplinary dimension of Jung. And, you know, what we call active imagination became the basis of all the expressive arts therapies. So people that work with dance, with poetry, with, you know, sculpture, with paintings, that has really taken off in the general psychotherapeutic world was in part inspired by Jung. The science part is really interesting because, yes, Jung always considered himself a natural scientist. And the alchemists, remember, were really the natural scientists of the Middle Ages. They thought of themselves as scientists. Jung chose to go into the medical sciences instead of the humanities, in part based on this amazing dream he had when he was young of a radiolarian, a large 3-foot mandala-shaped object that he saw in his dream in a river in the forest, and it was glowing. And Jung woke up from that dream. He said, my heart was beating with excitement, with a thirst for knowledge. And that dream propelled him into the natural sciences, into medicine, instead of the humanities. So Jung always had this thing for science, but it wasn't until he met Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel Prize winning quantum physicist in the 30s, and started what would become a 26-year-long collaboration with Pauli, that he felt there was a kind of science that was able to back up his experiences of the psyche, of the autonomy of the psyche, his paranormal experiences. It wasn't Newtonian science, it wasn't materialistic science, but it was quantum physics. And this is actually a huge intersection for Jung with alchemy, because of that, the joining of the natural sciences with depth psychology. This led to his theories of synchronicity, his extension of the archetype from being just a purely internal experience to something that inheres in the quality of matter, a kind of return of the soul to the world, so to speak. Science was crucial for that. He felt unable to write about synchronicity until he had the backing of Pauli in physics to do that. And so this was all related to alchemy, which was, you know, active imagination with matter, with stuff, with the world, not just a purely internal process, but one that was engaged with the world in that sense.
Yeah, so fascinating. And you have to wonder, I think, that if synchronicity was not at play in his very meeting of Pauli, because I'm sure that they probably had some common friends and worked in some common circles, but they really, the friendship that developed out of that and the letters that they wrote over those many years was something that was very special, I think. And as you look back on it, you have to wonder, you know, how that sort of emerged, and wonder if there wasn't a bigger pattern at work there. But yeah. I wanted to go back to active imagination for just a minute. I wonder if you can explain or just describe a little bit about how that worked specifically for Jung and how that led to the Red Book, or what parts of the Red Book, how does that show up in the Red Book, I should say. Mostly I asked that because I attended a fascinating course once on the Red Book that went through all of the images and a lot of the different drawings that Jung had done. And I had no idea at the time how alchemical some of those were. So I want to talk a little bit about alchemical images and how they show up in the Red Book. And one more question, not to draw this out too much, but maybe you can throw it in there if you think about it a little bit. And that is, you had mentioned that active imagination is in part about making the subjective psyche objective. And so what does that mean in sort of layman's terms? How would you describe what that looks like?
Well, I mean, instead of just being depressed, say, and being overcome by a depression, it's the capacity to imagine a depression, to turn it into an image. What does it look like? What is it saying? What is it? Where is it in your body? So that you make the mood, so to say, your object. You aren't just the passive victim of it, but you're engaged with it as an exterior thing, as something that you're not identical to. So active imagination starts off as a meditative practice. You can close your eyes, clear your mind. Maybe think about the emotion that's overtaking you. Say it's a depression. You know, allow yourself to start to feel what that really is feeling. Maybe images will start to emerge along with the depression. Maybe you imagine a dark pit or a black cloud or who knows what. See, with active imagination, it's a practice that is completely open to things appearing as they are. It's not a guided meditation. No one's telling you what you should see. There's no dogma saying what you should do if you see this or that. It's just empirical. It's just completely open to whatever appears to you. And then the important piece that Jung did, especially in the Red Book, was then not just viewing those images like passively as if they were a movie flashing before your eyes, but Jung stepped into that inner world of fantasy with his real personality. And there's a great German word that I've always loved to describe that, which is the Aus ein Andersetzung. It's the like the wrestling one another with the psyche. So that's what you really see in the Red Book in Jung's dialogues. Say a feminine figure, Salome, that Jung later would call the anima, appears to Jung and she says, oh, Jung, you know, you're the next Christ. You're the next Messiah. And Jung doesn't just accept that. He says, that's crazy. That's madness. You know, and he starts having an argument with her, having it out. And that became Jung's idea of through the interaction of conscious and unconscious, a process can take place that can unify them and produce a synthesis of something new. So, for instance, Jung got very upset with people that would start to do active imagination, but just would passively watch the inner world flow by. One man, for instance, said, Jung, a patient of Jung's, he said, oh, I saw something in active imagination. Jung said, what is it? I saw my fiance walking along an ice field over a frozen lake, and then the ice cracked and she fell in. Hmm. And Jung said, well, what did you do? He said, well, I just watched her fall in. Hmm. Jung got mad at him. He said, what would you do if that was real life? Because it is, it's real life. It's real inner life. It matters what you do. So that's the active part of stepping into this inner dream world with your real personality.
Yeah, and engaging. I mean, engaging. It's absolutely critical to engage. And in fact, I know that some people have some, not maybe not concerns, maybe they are, but some compunction about even the way that you go about active imagination. For example, I remember hearing that Robert Johnson, who is quite a well-known Jungian, has even some sort of rules for himself where before he steps across that threshold, he recommends that you do something to sort of create boundaries or a delineation or a container in which that work can take place. For example, I always heard that he put on like a lab coat or some kind of a special coat so that he would know when he was kind of ritually preparing to go into an active imagination, and then he could take it off when he stepped out to really be able to differentiate between the two.
Oh, that's great. I hadn't heard that. I think that's very good. One of my teachers in Switzerland said that you should only do active imagination for 20 minutes or 30 minutes maximum, because if you're really doing it right, it's hard work. You're not just zoning out. And it's great to have that ritual structure to it. So you step into it and then you step out of it. And it's very important to be able to do both. Jung in the Red Book said, for instance, I only went into the desert at night. That meant into his inner world at night. During the day, he had his practice and his family and his normal grounded life. And then also he was able to go into this inner world of the imagination. It's very important also to you write down what you are doing or paint it or give expression to it in some way. And then let that painting, say you make a painting based on your inner work, hang that up in your room somewhere. Let it stare at you. Let it work on you. Jung's main idea with it is that active imagination should produce an effect. If you really put yourself into it, it has a magical effect on the personality, the images that come out.
Yeah, that's great. I love that idea of letting it stare at you, because of course that brings in the whole idea of a dialogue and how the things are interactive and interconnected on so many levels.
That's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Mysterious. This mysterious connection between inner and outer is really what we're talking about that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, I'd like to spend a little more time talking about that, but maybe before we go there, it might be helpful to just briefly look at alchemy itself. We haven't done that as much as we have done it with active imagination. So can you share a little bit about what alchemy is, I guess, traditionally in a more traditional sense, and then also how Jung viewed it?
Sure, that's a great question. So alchemy is a tradition that exists all over the world. There's Chinese traditions of alchemy. There's, you know, Hindu, Indian traditions of alchemy. The one I'm most familiar with is in the Western tradition. And that really started in ancient Egypt over 2,000 years ago when the Greeks explored Egypt. Alexander the Great conquered Egypt. And the Greek philosophical ideas really began to merge with the Egyptian magical practices. The Egyptians were really good at mummification rituals, craft traditions. They were good with matter, with making things. And the Greek philosophical ideas, ideas like the four elements, for instance, began to, in a synchronistic way, you know, combine with the Egyptian magical practices. And that was the start of alchemy, the synthesis of Greek and Egyptian cultures. The alchemists in the West, starting in Egypt, were writing in Greek and they were Christians. And so from the very start there, they were really working with what we today call the shadow side of their religious traditions and of their cultures. This continued with the Islamic world. When the Islamic world conquered Egypt in the 7th century, the Islamic world discovered alchemy and translated the Greek texts into Arabic, and then brought those traditions into Europe. When the Islamic world was in Europe in the Middle Ages, the Jewish and Christian cultures in Europe rediscovered alchemy that way and translated the Arabic texts into Latin. And then Jung, of course, in the 20th century, rediscovered alchemy after a period of a couple hundred years where he had fallen out of favor completely due to the rise of science as we know it and the Enlightenment. Alchemy became nothing but a superstition. Jung rediscovered it as psychology in the 20th century. And, you know, his initial impression of alchemy was, well, it's ridiculous if you think of it as chemistry. It makes no sense. All the mythological imagery that we find in alchemy, the union of sun and moon, you know, the death of the king in the underworld, the dragons and all this stuff. But Jung said, oh, this is a huge thesaurus of images coming out of the collective unconscious. So he rediscovered it as psychology in the 20th century. And here we are today talking about it. So it's an over 2,000 year old tradition. Cross culture has nothing to do with the United States. Little to do with Europe, even. It's Islamic, it's Egyptian. So that's one of the things I appreciate about it.
Yeah, there's so much history in it. And it's just so laden with images. You had mentioned some of those, and I'm not sure if we'll have time to go into those today. It would be nice if we could, but I know that you'll probably go into those in the workshop. And if people want to really look at some of these images, I noticed that you can Google and you can find kind of repositories of places where people have stored these images online and these websites where you can find them. But they're really unique. And once you start looking at them, you start to realize that the symbolism that's involved in those is extremely profound. And so I know in the traditional alchemy, of course, we have a lot of the four elements play a pretty large role in there so that you can use those in different ways to change the material or the prima materia that has yet to be transformed. Can you explain that a little bit or describe a bit the process of what exactly alchemy is and what the end result would be if you do it successfully?
Sure. So I'll try in a nutshell. You know, it really is like Shakespeare. I mean, it's such a genius and very complex language of symbolism. But for me, the main idea in alchemy is this idea of the union of opposites, which is sometimes depicted as the union of the king and queen, the union of sun and moon, the union of spirit and matter, heaven and earth, above and below. You know, the opposites that in the Western tradition were split. The alchemists were working on reuniting those opposites. And so the work begins with a turning towards what we call the shadow, what's been repressed. Emotions, drives, dynamics, fantasies that are heretical, not allowed in the conventional religious culture of the times. And that includes a discovery, as we see in Jung's Red Book, of the whole lost feminine world of the unconscious. Lots of feminine imagery appears in alchemy. The alchemist tried to turn towards what was repressed and engage with it, in the hopes that a union of opposites can come out of it. And that's symbolized by the Philosopher's Stone, which is this enigmatic symbol of paradoxes. if you think of the four elements, for instance, you can get, like, as you asked, you know, in your question, you can get these strange alchemical recipes that at first seem nonsensical, but if you think about it a little bit, are pretty profound. So one is, there's a 2,000 year old recipe that says, turn the earth into water, turn the water into air, turn the air into fire, and then you'll reach the wisdom. So there you go. That's all you have to do. But if you think psychologically or symbolically or metaphorically, the earth is what's most solid. It's what's most dense. Brute facts, you know, so you could say raw drives, symptoms, a depression, an addiction, just where you're stuck in the concrete and literal. So to turn that into water is to make it a little less dense. It starts to flow. You can see that's like finding the images in the emotions. What are the images hidden in the raw brute facts of emotions? Turning that into air would be, what's the meaning of those images? You know, it's getting more and more subtle. And the fire is a light, you know, it's the illumination. It's that sort of spark where things aren't just up in the air as an idea, but where you get it. Like, where does it, it's that inner illumination where something sparks in you and a new process opens up from that. So this is Jung's basic idea of working with alchemy, is to see it as metaphor. And if you can do that, it's a genius, profoundly genius, experience. Yeah.
Yes. You know, for me, I just remember when I first learned about alchemy, and I had never heard of it until I really started studying Jungian psychology. And I suppose most people probably have not, but the ideas behind it, the metaphor, the story, the narrative, the symbols behind it seemed so instinctual to me. It seemed absolutely completely natural when I got it. And I kind of felt like I got it in an instant, the second that someone started talking to me about maybe the elements in that same way. This whole idea of everybody can relate to feeling stuck at some point, and to the idea that water actually helps things flow. So when you start bringing those elements in that way, it becomes very relatable, I think, on many levels, and therefore very understandable from a psychological perspective. But it was really Jung's genius that allowed him to see that and to parlay that into more of a common language for us.
Yeah, definitely. And Jung's experience of seeing those symbols in his own inner world, when he discovered alchemy, that was really for him a first contact with something outside of his own world that he thought he was all alone. He didn't know there was a precedent to the Red Book, say. And it's strange imagery that's heretical and weird. And he just thought, oh my gosh, I'm just the only one who's engaging in something like this. So when he discovered alchemy, he found a historical and cultural precedent. Mm-hmm. The experience of the alchemists were his experiences, and that was a big deal.
Right.
It's weird, but it's not so weird. I mean, if you say, oh, hey, Kobe Bryant was on fire last night in the game, you know, he scored 35 points again. No one thinks he's literally on fire. So it's just the same way of speaking that we do typically all the time and don't think about it.
Yeah, that's a great example. Great example. How do you think that alchemy is related to nature? And I ask that question specifically because, of course, I personally have a tremendous concern for what's going on our planet, and I'm looking at the ecological crisis that seems to be just unfolding around us. And I'm wondering how we might apply that to this particular time and situation that we're going through.
Yeah, that's a really great question, and not an easy question to answer. It's pretty stepping into pretty deep waters, but very relevant. I mentioned, for instance, Jung's long engagement with Wolfgang Pauli, their dialogues that were just on that question, you know, what does psychology have to do with nature? Mm-hmm. You know, so Jung, the psychologist, Pauli, the physicist, felt like they were tunneling towards each other from opposite sides of the mountain, hoping to meet and really coming up with a new vision of nature, not the old Newtonian clockwork deterministic universe in which nature has nothing to do with psyche. It's just dead. It runs along deterministic laws, like a machine. The dialogue with Pauli around alchemy opened up for them a new vision of nature that's also an old vision. It's a return to an animated world in which psyche and matter aren't split, but are mysteriously intertwined. But for Jung and Pauli, this was a return to the experience of the alchemists, who also didn't split psyche and matter like we typically do. There wasn't that division for them. For Jung and Pauli, that so-called conjunctio, or union of psyche and matter, now was seen as taking place in the microphysical world, and in the collective unconscious. So that was a new way to envision where that union is. But very much getting back to this idea of, like, as James Hillman writes a lot about, the anima mundi, the return of the soul to the world, that's very relevant to alchemy and alchemy now in the sense of quantum physics and what's opening up there.
Yes, absolutely. And I hope that you will talk more in the workshop about that connection again. And so maybe that's a good place, as we start to wrap this up, to just talk about the concept of synchronicity and how that connects back in here.
Okay. Yeah, synchronicity. Jung, you know, if you know a little bit about Jung, you know that he was having strange experiences his whole life from when he was little. Paranormal experiences, experiences in which matter was doing strange things. This really was difficult for him to deal with because he didn't have a way to conceptualize those experiences or think about them. So synchronicity is the experience that what Jung called the archetype, or the sense of meaning, inheres not just inside of me, inside of my dreams or my fantasies, but in the world. It's somehow a structure of the material world also, what Jung called the archetype. Right. So if we've had synchronicities, we have that experience. It's as if there's a meaningful connection between the inner world and what's happening outside. Mm-hmm. This was the experience of alchemy, really in a nutshell, and of active imagination. I remember when I was first doing active imagination, I was doing an analysis with an analyst in Switzerland. We were working over Skype. And I had a certain problem in my outer world that I was working with inwardly. And it was a really strange experience to me because in a very short period of time, the problem in the outer life seemed to really change. It was as if the people involved changed their attitudes and the whole thing was dissolved. That's an alchemical metaphor too. Different, changed. And I told this analyst in Switzerland, I said, you know, this was a weird experience for me. It's like magic, what happened. And I thought he would say, well, you know, that's projective identification, or let me explain why it seems that way. But instead he just said, yeah, it is, you know, and magic just means the inner and outer worlds are connected in a way we don't understand yet.
Yeah, it's the invisible world at work and those patterns that are all around us at all times. And yet, if we don't have the eyes to see, then we don't necessarily notice those linear connections because they don't exist to the naked eye, right?
That's a really good point. Yeah, it's a change in consciousness, a new way of seeing, a new perspective. And if we are able to do that, the outer world, you know, things work out differently.
Yeah, it begins to align in a whole new way. Yeah. That provides that context and meaning that we so desperately need in this individuation process that we're in our journey of life.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what we'll be going for in the workshop in March, is that exploration inwardly, outwardly, and the connections between the two.
Fantastic. It's great. It's really great, Tom. I just love the work that you're doing. I mean, it's just so rich and profound, and I think that everybody can benefit from knowing this. So thank you so much for spending the time to talk to me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.